This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In some midterm elections, candidates and their supporters worry no one will pay attention until Halloween. Although that doesn't seem like the case this year, Labor Day weekend is the traditional symbolic start of the all-out race to the election day in November, this year, November 6th. For a sense of how the big statewide races and local congressional races are shaping up, we'll be joined today by the Ohio Public Radio and Television Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles, Cincinnati Enquirer reporter covering Ohio government and politics, Jesse Ballmert, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. If you'd like to join the conversation, just call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome, everybody. Welcome back to the Friday session of Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you.
And some things have been happening. Joe, let's start in Columbus with the Cliff Rosenberger situation and where that stands and how that may – we can then sort of explore how that may impact what's happening in the campaign.
Yeah, looking at some public records requests, some documents that were requested as far as what was taken from former Speaker Rosenberger's office and what they might be looking into, we see that they are asking for the federal government is asking for information and things that pertain to former Speaker Rosenberger's travel overseas. He had traveled quite extensively, and they're looking at who he was traveling with, who was paying for that travel, and the situations around it. And they are looking at some pretty serious charges here, possibly. We don't know any more than that at this point. Is kind of suspect, but the things they were looking for are, you know, hard drives and schedules and different things that had to, you know, social media, different things that had to do with Speaker Rosenberger and what he was doing during the past couple of years and with whom he was doing them.
Jesse Ballmert, this is all being conducted by the FBI. And when there's an FBI investigation like this, there's no telling when results might be made public or any information might be made public. They operate on their own quietly. What impact do you think that is having or could have on the races that we're looking at in Ohio this fall?
Well, I certainly think it is looming large over the races for Ohio House in particular. And I know House Republicans are eager to point out that, Cliff Rosenberger was the only person listed on federal records. There was another state rep, Nathan Manning, from more northern Ohio, who was on this trip to London with the two lobbyists and a payday lending executive who went to London with Cliff Rosenberger. And I know Nathan Manning has, you know, said that he wasn't the subject of the investigation. So they're really trying to isolate it to Cliff Rosenberger. But Cliff Rosenberger was the head of the Ohio House and the leader of House Republicans. And I think that's something you'll see Democrats pointing out quite a bit. I think beyond the state house, you're going to have Democrats pointing to this quote unquote culture of corruption and saying, you know, one party has been in control for too long and this is what happens. People just start to run amok.
Well, yeah, I think she's right. Yeah. And, you know, the thing is that they didn't close the door to someone else being involved. I mean, they're looking at this stuff with Rosenberger and the lobbyist, but they're also keeping the door open for other people being involved with it. And that's something that the Democrats are sure to use.
Howard, one of the things that interests me about this is just as was being said, mm-hmm. This is fodder for the Democrats, and you throw in the situation with ECOT, with the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, and that whole mess. But what I don't see is I don't see the Democrats capitalizing on that.
Well,
I mean, that's what you'd expect, but I don't see it.
I don't see it in any kind of strong way, say from Richard Cordray, their candidate for governor. They seem to apparently be doing it in this coordinated campaign style, where you just blast out stuff from the state party that is supposedly to benefit candidates up and down the ticket. And Jesse was right. I mean, what they're out there arguing is, no, this is not isolated. This is not isolated to two or three people. It is a culture of corruption that has been ongoing for some time in the Ohio General Assembly, in the State House, and we are the only ones who can clean it up.
Yeah, and that, you know, it seems like the issue that's just sitting
right
there.
But it seems, but it's coming out of the Ohio Democratic Party. You hear other candidates, you know, down ticket candidates talking about it, but they're not. Nobody's paying any attention to them. Number one. And really, so far, I haven't heard Rich Cordray say a great deal about it.
Does that...
I mean, I think I've heard Rich Cordray campaign on ECOD. I think it's an issue that Democrats are hitting across the board. But perhaps less so than other issues he talks about.
You know what Mike DeWine has focused on as a way to distinguish himself from Cordray is the handling of the rape kits in the Attorney General's office. And my observation is he has a very effective commercial where a television commercial with a woman who was a victim basically telling the story and praising DeWine and criticizing Cordray. And what I don't see is Cordray coming back very hard on that. Joe, do you have...
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he's really not fighting back yet. I think... Honestly, I think they might be considering this a time period when people just kind of want to relax. They don't want politics. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. I think, you know, they're kind of sitting back and waiting until the public attention shifts.
Well, does the public attention shift on Labor Day or does...
Well, we don't know.
Or
because,
later.
I mean... One of the things that the public is preoccupied with is what's going on in Washington and in the White House and in Congress and the Mueller investigation. I mean, you know, people have a whole lot to chew over right now. And this is just one piece of, you know, what they – and they're not hearing a great deal. Now, I think that the Democrats and the Cordray campaign is going to come out and come out strong, but – I think they're holding back and letting DeWine get his shots in and then come back and answer him.
Jesse, speaking of what's happening in Washington, how important is the role of President Trump going to be? He has endorsed DeWine. He's criticized Cordray very strongly as a product of Elizabeth Warren. What role do you think the president will play in this Ohio gubernatorial race?
Well, I think the president will be very involved in Ohio because Ohio is an important state for him to keep returning to, keep his name recognition up. Not that that's ever really been an issue, but I think you'll see President Trump weighing in more in the U.S. Senate race with Jim Renacci, because Jim Renacci has really asked for that level of support. I think you'll hear it less from Mike DeWine, just because Mike DeWine has tied himself less closely to Donald Trump. But look, and Mike DeWine certainly wants the support of the president. He certainly wants the support of current Ohio Governor John Kasich. And so I think you will hear plenty of that. I also think Democrats want Trump to be lauding Mike DeWine, because then they can go say, look, Mike DeWine is Trump's candidate and we have to stop Trump. And I think that gets Democratic voters enthused in a way that, you know, maybe they wouldn't be beforehand.
Yeah. And another thing, I think, I think in this race there in particular, you know, over in the primary where they're dealing with their own party, they were going far to the right, far to the left, trying to get their, you know, whatever they're get their people out to vote. But in this election, this general election, they're going to be looking at those independents. And that's going to be super important to them. And I'm really interested in seeing how this plays out, because we started to see a hint of this in the 12th district race that just happened, where Governor Kasich endorsed Troy Balderson. And then we also saw President Trump coming in campaigning for Troy Balderson. Well, you know, when you've got these independents that maybe like John Kasich, but they can't stand Trump, if you've got that mixed message going on there, how's that going to play in the campaign? And I'm looking forward to actually seeing that play out this fall.
Now, if you're talking about the true independents, there's not very many of them.
That's true.
There may be 4 or 5% of the electorate, but in a very close race, they can make the difference. And I think, as far as Trump's concerned, when he comes to Ohio, if I were David Pepper running the Ohio Democratic Party, I'd want Donald Trump in Ohio every other day, because it will motivate his base to get out, get angry, and start working for these candidates to help get them elected. Now, on the other hand, it also motivates Trump's base when they see him, come in and do the fire-breathing speech. That fires them up. So I think both parties benefit from his presence in Ohio.
Well, sort of what Joe's saying. How's this going to play out? We're all going to have to watch that. What about in the Senate race? Joe, what are you seeing? The polls say that there's a pretty big spread there, anywhere from 13% to 17%. But what are you seeing in terms of movement, in terms of energy in that race?
You know, not a whole lot. Again, we're kind of where we are in the governor's race as far as not having a lot of, there's not a lot of energy out there on that race. But what we do see that's a little different than the governor's race is Congressman Jim Renacci is really closely tying himself to Trump. And actually that Trump factor has been maybe a little bit bigger in his race than it is in the governor's race.
And I think Jim Renacci is facing some challenges that Mike DeWine isn't. Jim Renacci is just less well known, especially in the Cincinnati area and even in the Columbus area. Some folks don't even know how to pronounce his last name. I think that's a challenge. I think he has fundraised less well than like Mike DeWine and John Husted have, something like $10 million on hand. And so those are going to be challenges. And really, Jim Renacci is banking pretty hard on the support of the president. And it will be an interesting test of whether Trump alone can drive that kind of enthusiasm, or, you know, just being Trump's guy or Trump's, you know, pick is going to be enough.
What he needs is Trump's mouth and Mitch McConnell's money.
Is he going to get Mitch McConnell's money?
No. Not in any major way. I mean, that's already been decided, you know, where that money is going.
The challenge on U.S. Senate races are the folks are trying to compete across the country, and they need to decide which races are most competitive, and they don't.
And
if they don't see Ohio as one, Ohio is an expensive state to compete in.
Yeah. And Sherrod Brown has always been pretty popular in Ohio, even with Republicans, you know, that are kind of independent-minded Republicans, I should say. A lot of them have voted for Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown agrees with the tariffs, maybe not how they're being done, but he agrees with the idea of strengthening the tariffs like President Trump has. He actually brings in some of those Trump voters that have voted for Trump in the past, and they like Sherrod Brown as well. So, I mean, that's going to be something that's going to play into this too.
Yeah, I think Sherrod can go up and down the Ohio River and pull in a lot of those votes that Donald Trump got 2 years ago. And there's no way that Renacci can reach them. He doesn't have the resources. He doesn't have the name recognition. He doesn't have the party organization behind him.
Which is interesting because Sherrod Brown has always been probably more liberal and more progressive mm-hmm. than the average Ohioan. And so it's interesting that he has,
but
know,
he's a populist type. Yeah.
He
mm-hmm.
is. He is a populist, a working man's guy.
Right.
Yeah. So, Jesse Bowman, just to sort of shift to another topic here, there was some development on one of the statewide issues this year, issue one, which was the title of the issue was released to reduce the penalties for crimes of obtaining, possessing, and using illegal drugs. That's really exciting. What's going on with this issue?
This is actually a pretty divisive issue. I think folks on both sides feel pretty strongly about it. The proponents of Issue 1 are saying that this would reduce drug penalties for fourth and fifth degree felony offenders. It would make it a misdemeanor. First, second, and thirds could still be charged as felonies. It would also add some things like you couldn't be sent to prison for a probation violation that isn't a new crime in of itself. So if you miss a meeting with your probation officer or, you know, don't pay restitution money back to victims quickly enough, you couldn't be sent to prison. And proponents are saying, you know, this is a way to address the heroin and opioid crisis as more of a disease and seek treatment as opposed to something that needs to be people who need to be locked up. And I think that's a direction you've seen Ohio and a lot of people go in recently. Those who oppose this initiative say that even a fourth degree felony amount of these drugs is still a lot of the drugs. It'd be several grams worth of drugs where a milligram of fentanyl could be deadly. And so the concern is that allowing people with this much of certain substances kind of off, like without the threat of prison, that could be problematic. And also the whole like carrot and the stick principle. A lot of drug courts are set up that, you know, you have to go to treatment, you have to do XYZ things. And if you don't, then you could face prison. Well, if there isn't that threat of prison, are people going to comply with treatment?
Yeah, and we're seeing right now that Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, Maureen O'Connor, is coming out hitting on this pretty hard. She's saying it would be a disaster, and it would make Ohio a haven for drug dealers. So, I mean, we're already seeing the lines being drawn, and there's going to be, as this goes on toward the election, there's going to be quite a battle over how much these drug levels, of how much they would how many drugs you'd have to have to hit certain levels, and some of the details of the plan, that's going to be debated, I bet, pretty heavily in the next couple of months.
So you think
months.
This is going to become a real issue?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, it will mm-hmm. be. I mean, the Chief Justice may be opposed to it, but Mark Zuckerberg is in favor of it for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, and that's kind of strange, isn't it?
It's very strange, yeah.
Yeah.
He suddenly came out in favor of Ohio Issue 1. Okay, well. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, I think the
for your
groups
input.
That were pulling together Issue 1 really kind of like shopped it out to groups that they thought would support these types of initiatives, and then they got $1 million.
They got
$1 million,
right.
As long as we're talking about drugs, Joe, you've reported this week on some developments in the Chillicothe prison that where two dozen people were impacted, were exposed, and some had to be hospitalized. Can you tell us any more of what you know about that and how it got in and why it was so many of the employees who were affected by this?
Well, yeah, mostly it was employees. It was mostly guards and nurses that were affected by this. There were a couple of inmates, but mostly the people who worked there. We don't know how that got in, but we do know that it was a combination of fentanyl and heroin. And what people have told me with these drugs is that even if someone's overdosing and they're using that combination. If I got near them, if I was breathing close to them, if I touched them, if I was doing anything that could contaminate myself with them, it would be like I would be overdosing too. I could overdose from it as well. Apparently, this is a very contagious. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but it's a situation that spreads very easily, and that's why you know these guards and these nurses were there was an inmate that was overdosing to begin with, and they were dealing with that, and that's how they got infected, if you will. And none of them, thank goodness, nothing appeared to be overly serious. No one died, and no life-threatening injuries or anything like that. But what we still don't know, and everyone's looking to find out, is how did this happen? I mean, how do you get to the point where you have an inmate who has that drug overdosing in their system, and, you know, you have all this going on? That's something they're going to be looking at.
Well, I want to get back to some more politics before we have to end this segment. And Howard, the first congressional district down here, the race between incumbent Republican Steve Chabot and Aftab Pirwal, the contender on the Democratic side, has started to heat up. Mm-hmm. And how would you assess what's going on there?
Well, I think it's going to be a very close race. At least that's the indications from what we're seeing happening now. The Chabot campaign has put up TV ads, which are extremely negative, attack ads, accusing him of crimes. And they're very tough and they're very harsh. And some of them cross the line in terms of, you know, the actual truth of the matter. Aftab, on the other hand, and that's usually what a guy who is running from behind does, you know, tries to tear down the opposition. And Aftab appears to be running like an incumbent. His ads are all nice and him playing softball.
Sunshine, slugger.
Sunshine, you know, my name means sunshine. And they're almost sweet. And then he talks about what he would do, you know, to help people in the district if he were elected to Congress. So it's a real confusing dynamic here, which makes me think that there are polls out there, internal polls, that show that this is a very tight race.
With a longtime incumbent.
And you got the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has got it targeted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jesse, what's your observation on that?
I think, unfortunately, for, you know, Cincinnatians who are watching their television, you're just going to be barraged by ads on this one. We just finished up the 12th Congressional District special election in Central Ohio, and it was just almost nonstop towards the end. And this race is actually closer. It's more competitive for Democrats than the one in Central Ohio that got so much more attention. And so I think this is going to be a race that nationally folks are looking at to pick up seats in the House for Democrats. They see this as one that they can win and they're going to spend money there. And so it's going to get worse before it gets better, I think.
And we've got some, you know, as much as Labor Day weekend is sort of you shift into high gear, there's still a lot of time between now and Election Day. And these races can shift tactics.
Although there is not as much time between now and when people can start to vote.
That's true.
The early voting.
The early voting, which is really important because
exactly.
So many people vote.
And a lot of these campaigns are going to focus on that.
Very good, Howard. So I want to thank Joe Ingles, Jesse Ballmer, and Howard Wilkinson for being with us today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. What happens when property owners default on their mortgages, fail to pay taxes for years, and walk away from the property? In some cases, those properties end up as the responsibility of the Hamilton County Land Bank. How well is the land bank taking care of the properties in their portfolio and moving them back into the market? For over a year, WCPO reporter Paula Christian has tracked that story and prepared a new report this week. Paula joins us today on Cincinnati Edition. If you'd like to join this discussion, please call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Paula, welcome
Thanks,
to Cincinnati Edition. So first off, the land bank, what is it, so that people who may not have seen your report and may not fully understand it?
Well, it's a nonprofit created by the government to be a holding place.
Which is why it's quasi-governmental?
Yes, exactly. So it's designed to be a holding place for properties that have nowhere else to go. They're either can't be financially or other kept up by their owners. They can't pay the taxes. They can't keep up with the property maintenance. It gets forfeited. It gets donated to the land bank in some cases. It's supposed to be a holder for last resort properties until they can be renovated or demolished.
And what's the relationship of the land bank to the port?
The port oversees the land bank. In Ohio, more than 50 counties in Ohio have an operating land bank. And the idea is a good one because before the creation of land banks, these properties would just sit and deteriorate, and nobody was taking any responsibility for them. The owners had maybe moved away long ago, and they weren't paying the fines. They weren't up, and there was nobody to answer for the condition of these properties.
So what's your argument about how well the Hamilton County Land Bank is handling the properties? And as I mentioned, they have over 800. Mm-hmm. In your report, you said 850. I talked to the head of the land bank this morning, and she says 820. It doesn't make any difference. It's over. There's a lot of properties.
Their property list also fluctuates almost daily.
Right.
And so, you know, we had prepared this report over the summer, and that list does go up and down. But, you know, to your point, does it matter 820 or 850?
It doesn't. So, yeah. So what is your argument here about how they are taking care of them?
Well, in the vast majority of cases, the properties look pretty good. The grass is, I mean, it depends on the neighborhood. In Evanston, for example, the properties looked good. The grass was mowed. They have new houses going up where old ones were demolished. In other neighborhoods,
I might point out that in Evanston, the port has a major
initiative.
So there's a lot of focus there.
Yes. In other neighborhoods, it almost seems as if the port has, I mean, the land bank has forgotten about the properties. Last year, I went around to Madisonville. I went to Evanston. I went to Price Hill, all over the place. And it seemed as if last year Madisonville was kind of forgotten. There was a number of properties that just, frankly, were even the neighbors who lived next door to these properties were upset. The weeds were knee high. Looks like it hadn't been mowed all summer. Vines literally overtaking these properties to the point of you couldn't even see parts of the structure.
Well, one of the things the land bank says is that in the past year they've increased the number of contractors that they have going out and mowing, and they've increased the number of times that yards are being mowed. At, you know, 17 is their standard. They're going to be mowed,
yes,
17 times in a summer. Now, that's not as much as a homeowner ought to mow when you think about grass starting,
yeah,
to grow in March and
well, whatever. I would just make the point that the fact that they increased the number of contractors is great, and that's a step in the right direction. But when we reported on this last year, they had two landscaping contractors mowing the 700 properties they owned in the entire county, which is it doesn't even make any sense how you could only have two landscaping contractors. So the fact that they increased that is great, but they had to. And the properties that I saw,
looked as if they had not been mowed all summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also make the point that, you know, the land bank was fined $115,000 by the city of Cincinnati for tall weeds and grass and litter on 97 different properties. And if they were all being mowed twice a month, would they have that number of fines?
Okay. And on this question of litter as well, now the land bank would try to argue that there are third parties. They can go out and clean up a lot, and then somebody else can dump and on that property, and they're right back to where they started from. It's not that they haven't done anything, but that, you know, they can't be there every day type of thing.
And that's a very valid point. The neighborhoods that they own property in are sometimes not the best in the city, and that's going to happen. So I understand that point. But the one lot in particular that we looked at in Price Hill on Wells Avenue, while some of it had been cleaned up, the side lot was almost identical from the picture we took in 2017 to the picture I took in 2018. And I don't know how you can explain that.
So where does the money come from for the land bank? You mentioned $1.4 million.
Mm-hmm. It's, well, the county and the city each give $700,000 to the port each year, but the majority of the land bank funding comes from delinquent tax collections. So in effect, the taxpayers are paying for this.
So my understanding is that if you pay your taxes late, you're going to get a delinquency fee.
Yes.
And then that goes to the land bank,
yes,
to try to handle it. So
yes.
Now, it's interesting, in your situation, in your report, you make the point about the $1.4 million of government money, of tax money. In some documents I saw from them, from the land bank, they say their term is our limited budget resources. So, question of perspective here.
I haven't examined their budget. I don't know what they're spending their money on. But the most basic function of what they're doing, which is upkeep of property, which is their front-facing window to the world, which is what all the neighbors see, which is what we're all listening to right now, which is what was on our TV broadcast last night, how their properties look. I don't know what they're spending on that, but
The other part of that is, besides maintenance of the properties, is to move these back into some sort of meaningful use, get them back into the market some way. And I think that was another point that you were trying to make. And particularly the developer that you interviewed in your report, that it took a long time to get through the process. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Well, this house on Chandler Street in Madisonville is one that I had photographed last year, and it was such a pretty little house, and it was literally being swallowed up by these vines. And when I drove around this past summer and saw it being renovated, I was so happy to see it being brought back to life. So I went in and I spoke to the man who's rehabbing it, and he talked about the saga it took to get this property from the land bank and how they had been, it took them a year to acquire it. And he said, he's been developing properties for 30 years. It was the first one he's ever gotten from the land bank. And he said, honestly, I'm not sure I would do it again because the price was great, but I can't wait a year through the red tape and the bureaucracy to acquire a property. He said that it seemed like they just wanted to demolish anyways.
I wonder if – I think it is, again, because I had the opportunity to talk to Jessica Powell this morning. She called me at the land bank. Her point was that it's not just the land bank's rules. It's when they take over these, there is no there's no mortgage that's available. There's no title. The titles have been lost. The titles have been are in abeyance. There's taxes to be paid. There's lots of agencies involved in this. It's not just the land bank. So that time that those developers find so frustrating, it's not just the land bank. It's the whole process of vacant property.
You know, I would just say this is their job. And this is what they're getting taxpayer money to do. So if it's not working, then it should be fixed. And how it gets fixed is not for me to say.
Okay. Seems like – and you're, the final point here is you talked about the citations that were on properties that are in the hands of the land bank.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a twist here because we started with the question of quasi-government status.
Yes.
How much have they had to pay on that?
They don't pay the fines.
Because?
So, because they are a quasi-government agency. They're considered a nonprofit, so they are exempt from fines. So the neighbors of these properties, if their grass grows too high, they are hit with a $750,000 fine that they have to pay. And if these fines accumulate, they could lose their house. So, but the land bank can let their grass or weeds or litter get out of control, and they don't pay the fines, which was particularly frustrating to neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very interesting report. It's available online at WCPO.com. And people can go take a look at that and dig in. And thank you for the reporting. And Paula Christian, thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Bike Share came to Cincinnati 4 years ago. Last month, a flock of electric bird scooters landed on downtown streets and sidewalks. For over 80 years, the street has been the exclusive domain of cars and trucks. Introducing bikes and scooters poses all sorts of challenges. To discuss how the city is trying to respond, we are joined today by Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Hannah Sparling and WCPO reporter Pat LaFleur. If you would like to join the conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome back, both of you, to this. I do want to say right off the bat that Red Bike came out of Leadership Cincinnati at the time that I ran it, so I do have a bit of a conflict of interest here, so, and care a lot about Red Bike. But anyway, so there's been a lot of attention, Hannah, to the problems with the bird scooters that have that have appeared. Are there similar issues with the Red Bikes?
I think similar issues, and Pat, let me know if you disagree. I think it's similar, but it seems to be heightened with the bird scooters. So both of these are supposed to be ridden or driven, I suppose, in the streets, and they're not supposed to be on the sidewalks. You do see both of them on the sidewalks occasionally, but I think the bird scooters more. I see them almost exclusively on sidewalks.
Although I see them on streets, too. I mean, I see them. I see the scooters in the streets.
That's good.
But not necessarily going in the right direction on one-way streets. But
well, there's
anyway,
that.
There's that.
I would agree. I think the reason why I think I'm seeing more scooters lately is A, because they're newer and they're considerably cheaper to rent a bird scooter than it is to rent a Red Bike. So I think that's the combination of those two things. And, you know, the scooters are much smaller. And, you know, before e-scooters became a thing that were even on the streetscape, you had, you know, little Razor scooters that would always be ridden by kids on the sidewalk. So I think there was as much of a notion that that's just where they belong. But unfortunately, that's not the case.
Now, from a legal point of view, what is the law about bikes, whether it's a Red Bike or your own personal bike or a scooter? Where do they have to be? What kind of laws apply to both of these types of vehicles?
It's the same for each of them. You're supposed to ride them in the street as if you're a car, basically. So you stop at red lights. You go the correct way down one-way streets. You follow all the same rules you would as you're driving. For bikes, there is an exception if you're a child. But other than that, in the street, no exceptions, really.
Yeah, and the thing about bicycle law is that once you cross a municipal border, that rule could change. Mm-hmm. It can also sometimes depend on the zone of the neighborhood that you're in. For instance, let's use where I am from, Mainstross in Covington, as an example. That's an entertainment district, a lot of outdoor seating along, you know, the main street there.
On the sidewalks.
Yes. Yeah. Outdoor seating on the sidewalk. So anyone riding a bicycle technically is prohibited from doing so on the sidewalk, even as a child. Now on more residential streets, that law or that rule changes. So it's very, very nuanced. And that's part of the reason why it's so difficult to enforce.
Are you aware of police ticketing people riding either of these? And I mean, scooters are more recent. Having ticketed people that they feel are not following the rules, are tickets being issued?
To my knowledge, no.
I haven't heard of a case of a person being cited with either.
Any sense of whether the Bird scooters have cut into the business model of red bikes? I mean, the Bird scooter, I see, all of a sudden, I just see everybody seems to be on Bird scooters.
It might be too early to tell what the real impact will be on red bike. But I've spoken with people at red bike over the last few weeks, and I haven't caught wind of any concern on their part.
I think they're still kind of waiting to see. The thing with red bike is a lot of the users are annual pass holders. And so that's a different choice you're making. The way it might cut in is for someone who's taking a single trip at a point in time and they're choosing, do I want to bike or take a scooter?
Another thing with the scooters is that, you know, you have the app to try to find one, but there's no guarantee that there's going to be one near you.
I've struck out several times trying to find them.
With the scooter?
With the scooter.
You mean the scooter isn't where the app told you it was?
It says you're standing on it, but it's not there.
I've had mixed results with it as well. And that could be as basic as just simple GPS signal being lagging between the satellite and your
mobile
phone.
Or it's in a basement
somewhere,
right, or something like that.
One question I want to ask, it's not strictly a law question, but it's a practice question. What about helmets with both of these, riding with helmets? Now, I think I've said this to Pat before. I, on a red bike, took a very bad fall because I didn't understand, stupidly, wasn't paying attention, on a streetcar track early on. And I realized, and from that point on, I kept a helmet on my desk downtown and at my office. And anytime I went, I got a helmet on. Is there any law, any provision for that sort of safety question?
Well, it's written in the rules that Bird set forth in the app saying you should wear a helmet with this. Mm-hmm. And even the city's interim guidelines, I think, mention a helmet, maybe.
Yeah, it seems it's more of a suggestion, though, than a law, I think. So yeah. When you open the app and you rent a scooter, it tells you to put on a helmet. When you hop on a red bike, it says wear a helmet on the rules right there.
It does.
But you don't have to. And no. I think it's pretty rare for people who ride all the time, they might have a helmet with them. But if you're just going out for lunch or something, you don't have one in your pocket.
I always made the point was anybody in the office could borrow my helmet on any one day. I just highly recommend the use of a helmet.
And Bird will send you a helmet for free.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You have to request it, but they'll send you one. I think it's more a matter of convenience for people.
And now, depending on how wonky we want to get, there are people who will make the case that streets should be designed so that you can ride slowly enough that a helmet shouldn't be necessary. Now, I'm not saying that I adhere to that logic, but there is a camp in the cycling community that kind of rallies against helmet requirements.
Well, okay.
Point of view.
Too many people I've known have gotten some serious injuries if they fall.
Of course.
We've gotten a call from Sean. And Sean, I think you maybe have a particular interesting perspective on this.
Yes, thank you. I'm a downtown, I live and work downtown, actually about to say downtown resident. So I've had a lot of experience with red bikes and Bird scooters, both as someone sharing roads and sidewalks with them, and I've used both of them myself. I'm also a former bike messenger from many years back, around 2001, 2002. So got a lot of experience with riding downtown and particularly in the streets. One of the first things I wanted to note was from the introduction to your piece, you mentioned that the roads have been almost exclusively the domain of cars for the past 80 years, but that itself was a change. Before that, the roadways were for, you know, horse-drawn buggies and bicycles and pedestrians. So some of it is kind of readjusting the mindset away from roads being exclusively for cars and being for multimodal transportation.
I absolutely agree. It's the historian in me, and I've written about this, that that's why I put that sentence in there. I'm glad you picked it up. I didn't know anybody listened to me that closely. But I agree with you. There is a mental shift that we all have to go through here. So
the one other thing I wanted to comment, if I could, is as a former bike messenger who has a lot of experience riding in the streets downtown, I've always been struck at how safe it tends to be, the new streetcar tracks notwithstanding. But the drivers tend to be very respectful there, and it ends up being much safer for pedestrians, for those to be riding, for bike riders, and I would say probably bird scooter riders, having done it myself, to ride in the street versus on the sidewalk. Few things get me more upset as a bike rider than seeing bikes being ridden on the sidewalks or the wrong way down the one-way streets, giving a bad and, you know, bad portrayal of other bike riders to drivers and pedestrians downtown.
Hannah, Pat, any comment here?
Well, as a bike commuter myself, I would absolutely completely agree with Sean's comments there. Especially about the notion that it is very safe to ride your bike downtown. Hannah, we were actually just talking about this before coming in here, that the cars just aren't moving fast enough to really create the kind of threat that you'd get outside of the central business district on some bigger roads like Gilbert or Reading, or where cars definitely speed.
Well, we have another caller, Mike, who is calling in and has a observation he wants to share on the safety question. Mike, what is your point?
Well, hey, it's nice to be with you. I actually was hit by a car when I was 7 years old while walking on the sidewalk with about a 20-foot tree lawn. So that was part of my early life. And my daughter, who's 22, was riding bikes downtown in Cincinnati, and her tire, like yours, Dan, got caught in the streetcar groove and threw her, and she was badly injured. So, you know, again, I guess I'm reflecting on what everybody's saying. How do we allow different types of transportation on the same roads? I don't see people driving cars, yielding to pedestrians or bikers, and it worries me for everybody's safety who's not in a car, especially.
Okay. Anybody want to join in on that
one? The streetcar thing, my brother also took a nasty fall that same way, so I don't really know what the solution is there.
Well,
myself, I just avoid them.
Yeah, I think it's cut across them at a 90-degree angle. I mean, that's what you got to
– That's exactly what the city says to do.
Mm-hmm. You just got to – you got to learn. It's like anything else. I just didn't pay attention. I think everybody – but you don't want too many people to do that. So,
Right. Well, that's why they have those big signs now with the kind of dramatic –
falling
depiction
off.
Of a cyclist getting stuck.
I modeled for that. And we're almost out of time, but Dave Mann has suggested what?
Yeah, so David Mann this week introduced a motion that would basically require Bird to be responsible for when scooter riders break the rules. So that's interesting. Like, legally, it's going to be a tricky question, I think, but that's what he's pushing.
Definitely. And I don't think it was a coincidence they dropped when council is on recess over the summer.
And very good. We'll come back to that then. Thank you, Hannah and Pat, for being with us today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Segment producer, Layla Shikui. The technical director, Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.